This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last week, the National Gay Advocacy Organization Human Rights Campaign released a report called the Municipal Equality Index. It rated more than 300 cities around the country on the basis of how inclusive their city laws and policies are for LGBT people. The five Vermont municipalities included in the study ranged from a score of 89 in Burlington to 56 in Rutland. Essex, South Burlington, and Montpelier fell somewhere in between those two. Catherine Oakley is legislative counsel for state and municipal advocacy at the Human Rights Campaign. She pointed out that the national average score was 59, so Vermont isn't doing too badly.
You know, Vermont does have a little bit of a leg up because it does have such good state laws. And so what I would say is that, sure, being above the national average is a good thing, and Vermont certainly has nothing to be embarrassed about. On the other hand, you know, Vermont, I think, is the kind of place that likes to think of themselves being really on the cutting edge of equality, at least in some places, and that I think that some of the cities in Vermont could stand to take a look at the report and create a to-do list for themselves for next year.
Oakley says the Municipal Equality Index doesn't really measure what it feels like to be LGBT in these cities.
What this report is really looking at are the laws and policies of each city. So we're talking about, for example, does a city have a non-discrimination policy that applies to everybody in the city? Do they also have a non-discrimination policy that applies to their city employees? Are they offering equivalent benefits? And, of course, in Vermont, the cities are all offering equivalent benefits. Are they offering transgender-inclusive benefits to their city employees? So, you know, when we're looking at benefits for city employees, that doesn't necessarily extrapolate out to how great it feels to be an LGBT person who's in Burlington or an LGBT person who is in Rutland. And so it's not talking about that feeling. What it really means for the people who live in those cities is it is a symbol for from the city government to say, look, this is we take LGBT people very seriously. We believe treating them with respect is absolutely critical. And, you know, we're not going to just say it. We're also going to do it. We're going to make sure that our city policies are as inclusive as they possibly can be.
So this report looks at legal standing for individuals, but what does it feel like to live in Vermont if you're lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or queer identified? We'd like to hear your thoughts and experiences. A lot of people have been sharing their thoughts with us already on the Vermont Edition Facebook page and at vpr.net. You can also call with your thoughts. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You know, we talked about five different cities in Vermont, but what about some of the other places in the state? Does it feel inclusive if you're living in the Northeast Kingdom, if you're living in a rural town in southern Vermont? Wherever you are, wherever you find yourself on the spectrum, we'd love to hear your experiences and your thoughts. So again, post them at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. H.B. Lazito is executive director of Green Mountain Crossroads, a Brattleboro nonprofit that's focused on building visibility for rural LGBTQ folks in New England. H.B., welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks so much for having me.
And Meg Tamulonis is a former board co-chair of the Pride Center of Vermont and a caretaker of the Vermont Queer Archives. Excuse me. Meg, thank you for joining us as well.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Meg, you work in Burlington and you live in Burlington. So does a score of 89 for the city sound about right to you from that survey we were hearing about?
It kind of does. I think that there are things that could improve in Burlington for how it feels to live here, but certainly 89 seems reasonable.
So in terms of laws, at least 89 seems right. But what do you think could improve in terms of the way it feels?
There are still people on the streets who might feel free to comment on LGBT people when they walk by. I think there is still that feeling of exposure. I am always seeking LGBT community within Burlington, and I've certainly found it, as I'll talk about more. But I think there's more and more community that we can develop here.
Interestingly, before we leave this survey that HRC did, the city of Burlington had a score of 89, but two next door communities, Essex and South Burlington, were both in the 50s. So I suppose that probably speaks more to the municipal laws in those communities than to the feeling. Do you think Burlington itself, that little nebulous of Burlington, has some different feel than the rest of the state?
I do. I mean, obviously, I have my own experience within the state, but I do have some familiarity with Burlington and some of the outlying areas in Chittenden County. And the feeling does certainly change when you move from Burlington to another city or town nearby.
Even if you're just moving from Burlington into South Burlington, you cross that city line and it feels different?
I think so, yes. I'll be curious to hear what people say when they call in, but yes.
HB, Brattleboro wasn't ranked in this survey. What score would you give it based on what you know about the municipal laws?
Yeah, it's interesting. That was actually one of the first things that caught my eye when I was looking over the survey. I said, oh, Brattleboro is not ranked, which actually wasn't that surprising to me. I think overall, as a municipality, things are great. One of our select board members is LGBTQ identified, so there's some real support there within town government. But as folks have already talked about a little bit, you know, that's not necessarily really where our challenges lie, at least in Brattleboro proper, I'll say. There's a lot of other contributing things, which I'm really excited to get into, that are contributing to the feeling and the lived realities of people in this place. So,
well, go for it. Let's dive right in. So when you say that are contributing to the feelings, good feelings, bad feelings, give us the scope.
Sure. I think it's a lot of good and bad, for sure. It's, you know, it's very high on both ends of that spectrum. Our community here is very interesting. It's very multi-generational. It's very cross-identity. It's, I think, one of the realities of living in a rural place is that LGBTQ communities, there's everyone coming together all at one time, which creates a lot of interesting things. You know, in cities, you maybe have a party for a very specific cross-section of the community, whereas here, you know, when we throw a big dance party, it's for everybody, which is amazing and also has its own challenges. Along with things like access to healthcare, the Municipal Index talked a little bit about are municipalities offering trans healthcare to people? What does that look like? But we're finding in a lot of cases, even if those types of insurances are offered, are the providers competent? Are the providers, you know, giving the level of care that people need to feel comfortable? So those are some of the issues that we're dealing with.
Can you just go into that a little bit more too, HB, for people who are, you know, maybe hearing for the first time that there might be different medical needs or different sensitivities that a doctor or a healthcare professional might need to have with a trans person who's coming in for care?
Sure. Yeah. I think, you know, it starts very early in the medical process, right? What do the forms look like that the people are filling out? Is there a level of understanding that trans people and or queer people maybe want to be called a different name than is their legal name? How are you handling that within the medical care system? So I think it starts from even before you have an appointment. And then, you know, what is that bedside manner of your care provider? Are they able to talk in a language that makes the patient feel comfortable with their body, feel comfortable with how they're being addressed? And then there's the whole other sort of physical and mental health care issues that actually, you know, are people getting the care they need? Are they not? There's a lot there.
HB just mentioned, you know, different communities, and that when you're in a small place like Brattleboro and you're throwing a big dance party, it's for each of those letters in that long string of letters, you know, LGBTQ. You know, so Meg, for you, when you think about the community, is that even a valid term to say the gay community, as if it encompasses everybody? And does it have to be that way because we're in a rural state, that there's a small population, so there's a strength in numbers, even if the trans community might have different issues, different concerns, and different interests than the lesbian community?
Absolutely. And that's something we talk about a lot at the community center and certainly within work on the archives. It does need to be overarching and inclusive of all of those letters and identities. And that certainly can sometimes cause tensions in conversations.
Like what? Give me an example.
A feeling of being excluded from certain groups or certain activities. We do not want to be exclusive, but we do want to be supportive of all of the different identities that come to us for different sorts of events.
But when might there be tension within the community, in quotes?
I think sometimes there's tension even in the telling of history of the community, which is part of the reason, for example, with the archives, when we do exhibitions, we say, we know this is one point of view. There are many voices that can tell the history of the queer or the LGBT community in Vermont. And we really ask people to become involved in talking about that.
HB, jump in here. What do you think about that potential for tension?
Yeah, I think that's huge. I mean, we've started saying we're looking at building a community of communities, right? Mm-hmm. It's all one community together, but everyone has their own interests and their own specific needs. Like you were saying a little bit earlier, Jane, I think, you know, we find a lot of tension and a lot of challenges around word use. Who feels comfortable with what? What are the histories of different words and how they're impacting individuals currently? How we're marketing events affect who comes to them or who feels welcome or those types of things.
Yeah, and you know, certainly I'm not asking either of you to represent a whole community or even a community of communities, because you're speaking from your own experiences and from your professional lives, which are both involved in thinking about these issues and thinking about the building of resources and networks. You know, Meg, can you talk a little bit about the Pride Center of Vermont, which you were a board co-chair of in the past, and the Queer Archives?
Yeah, so I actually just ended my second term on the board at the Pride Center of Vermont. Very sadly, but it was time. It's an amazing group of people. And I have been involved with the Pride Center since about a year after its founding in 1998, 1999. So I've been involved for 15 years or so. And also from that very beginning, I've been a volunteer with the Vermont Queer Archives. And what I find very interesting, and I do know there is terminology around that that people need, we do need to talk about more.
Terminology around the word queer.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that program was started by the founders of the Pride Center, formerly known as the RU12 Community Center. So again, talk about terminology and names and so on. But that was started at the very beginning as a way of acknowledging all of the different communities and the past that organizations like the Pride Center are really building on. So we are, you know, the founders really wanted to be very, very aware that they were standing on the shoulders of people who had done amazing activism work in Vermont and elsewhere.
And HB, Green Mountain Crossroads, this is an organization that you founded in the Brattleboro area, and it's working on building visibility for rural LGBTQ folks in New England. So that sounds like there's a need that you see that needed to be filled.
Yeah, well, I'll clarify. I didn't actually found Green Mountain Crossroads. We are a very new organization. I came on as ED in April.
Got it.
But we had been working together for a long time. I did start a different organization called Homo Promo, which is continuing to work in Brattleboro doing very similar things. So just a point of clarification there. Meg was talking about standing on the shoulders of other people and legacies of organizing. We definitely have a strong legacy here in Brattleboro and in Vermont. But the work that Green Mountain Crossroads is doing is, you know, it's critical. When I moved here, you know, I knew there were other LGBTQ people here. I didn't know how to find them, who they were, what they were interested in. Those types of things, I think, just bringing that sort of stuff out. You know, we don't have a community center here in Brattleboro. We don't have any places that are specifically for LGBTQ people to gather. So we're creating a lot of those ad hoc spaces and making opportunities for people to come together and find each other.
We're talking today about the lived experiences of identifying as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer in Vermont, what it's like to live here, what you think could be better, and what you think might help having a community space. If you have a question or if you'd like to share your thoughts, your experiences, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can write to us. Our email address is vermontedition@vpr.net. We got a note from Jane who says, I believe you have to move and live somewhere else where you have no rights to really appreciate what Vermont has in place for the LGBTQ community. I moved to Atlanta, Georgia and lived there for 6 years. The first time I was ever fired in my entire life was just for being myself, a lesbian. I was 31 years old and it almost crushed my spirit. They realized I was gay and then fired me because they were a very religious family and felt that I shouldn't be around their child. When I lived in Vermont, nobody cared about my personal life. And even better, there are laws in place that don't allow people to simply fire someone for being LGBTQ. I didn't know how good I had it until I left. Sharon writes, Vermont is way better than Florida, where I currently live. Down here, it's all Bible thumpers who want to remind you every day that you're going to burn in hell if you are gay. No place is perfect for sure, but Vermont is far more accepting than other places in the country. But Brian says, my impression is that Burlington is pretty good to great and better than most places in accepting individuals rules, but that doesn't make it a wonderland. It's still a small place, and being a small minority in a small place is a tough thing. My friends who are LGBTQ appreciate the relative respect they get here, but still struggle with being isolated and lonely due to the small population, leaving them fewer social options with people who identify in the same way they do as compared to large liberal cities. And just on the other end of things, we got a note from Judah, who says, Vermont is a hateful place when it comes to gays. I came here 3 years ago, not for anything gay, but just to live my life in peace with my neighbors. And I can safely say, hypocrites and liars. Just two nights ago, somebody drove by in the dark, and I heard some woman scream out the window, queer, and the truck careened off into the night. Meg, you're shaking your head. What are your thoughts hearing all of those comments?
Well, I'm really struck by Judah's last comment, certainly, and I'm wondering where Judah is. Mm. But, you know, those sort of drive-by comments, I sort of was mentioning that a little bit on the street, those happen everywhere, I think. I mean, it, certainly in my experience, they happen in Burlington as well. But for somebody who's not right in Burlington and is isolated and can't talk or doesn't know if they can talk to somebody else about that sort of experience, it's even more isolating and disturbing. But that's familiar.
Hmm. HB, for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, also struck by Judah's comments and struck by the people who are writing in from the South, I think, holding up that there's some really amazing organizing that's happening there. Southerners on New Ground, Song, is an organization that's doing some incredible rural LGBTQ organizing in the South. So encourage folks to look them up and connect with them down there. Yeah, I think that the issue of isolation and feeling like you're alone and like you're the only person is really huge. You know, even if your neighbors on your street are accepting, maybe they don't really want to talk about it, but they'll be nice to you. You know, they'll help you come and shovel after a big winter storm, that kind of thing. But I think even in Vermont, you know, the experiences of that daily kind of harassment is very real for people.
You know, actually, we got a note about that kind of idea that you have neighbors who don't, you know, you don't need to discuss it, but we'll do whatever you need to do. Vera wrote in to say, I was not at all surprised that Vermont was the first state to allow civil unions because it was very much in keeping with what I feel is the Vermont spirit, which is do whatever you like in your own home. I don't know my neighbor's business, but I do know that I can still borrow the lawnmower if mine is broken. That was a strength at the start of this, but now it's a problem because a decade or so back, I don't really care what you do in your home, was ahead of most of the country. Now it's starting to drag us down by the unspoken addendum to that attitude, which is just don't do it where I can see it. I think that this is where all the closeting in more rural areas comes from. I don't feel it's necessarily out of some fear of bodily harm, but just this sense that nobody wants to know about that side of you. So why tell them? Do you think that's true, HB? I mean, there is this idea that you can ask your neighbors for help, but maybe you don't share your personal lives.
Yeah, you know, I read that comment this morning on the VPR website, and I thought, you know, that really is true. I think that kind of notion, that idea is very, you know, almost old at this point, that you should keep it to yourself, keep it over here. You know, I mean, I think one issue that we talk about all the time, right, is the classic, oh, it's a choice, this is a choice. You know, and I often say, even if it is a choice, it's a choice that I would make a million, billion times over and over and over again. I think one of the things that we talk about in our work a lot is, you know, being LGBTQ isn't just okay. It's amazing and it's wonderful. And it's something that people should be able to celebrate and talk about, and not just once a year at Pride.
We are talking today about the experience of living in Vermont as an LGBT person, and we're asking about how to form community when there's a lack of spaces for people to gather. There are few, if any, gay bars in the state, not to mention bookstores and other commercial venues, but there are gay nights at bars, there are individual book clubs, there are organizations geared towards helping LGBT youth. So what does that mean? Does it mean that there's a need for more space, the right kind of spaces? Are people gathering in non-public spaces, forming their own communities? We want to know what you think about this idea of community space. You can call 1-800-639-2211 or write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're spending some time talking about the gay community in Vermont, and if it's even accurate to phrase it that way. We're actually just opening up the discussion of what it's like to be lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer in a rural place. And we're starting to move now into a discussion of what kinds of spaces are important to create a welcoming and supportive community. Are gay bars gone because they're no longer needed? because that particular kind of space is no longer needed? Is there a gap that still needs to be filled? You can call 1-800-639-2211 to comment on that or to share your own experiences. That number again, 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And joining us today in this discussion are H.B. Lozito, Executive Director of Green Mountain Crossroads, a Brattleboro nonprofit, and Meg Tamulonis, a former board co-chair of the Pride Center of Vermont and a caretaker of the Vermont Queer Archives. And we've got Melissa here calling in from Outright Vermont. Hi, Melissa. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts specifically on the need for community. Is that what you're asking?
Sure. You called us. What do you want to talk about, Melissa?
I was asked to call to talk a little bit about queer youth. Outright is the only organization in Vermont working specifically with queer youth. When we saw the results from the Human Rights Campaign survey, it was very telling about Burlington and some of the other more populated places in the state. But the experiences of queer youth is actually really different than those statistics might have you believe.
Mm.
There are a lot of legal protections in Vermont, and in Burlington specifically, there are a lot of progressive laws in the state of Vermont, and we're really lucky to have that. But queer youth specifically aren't necessarily benefiting from those laws, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so what do you think needs to be done?
Well, I think the experience of queer youth is one that is harder in Vermont because we're specifically a rural state. The biggest issue queer youth are facing is isolation. So that conversation about community and the need for community spaces was really resonating with me because that is something that we actively strive to provide our community spaces, specifically in Burlington and outside of Burlington. As a statewide organization, we're constantly looking for ways to provide space and to provide ways for queer youth to connect to each other.
And is that harder to do in places outside of Burlington? I mean, isn't it harder to find a space that then you can fill consistently?
It is harder to do specifically because there's fewer people. I think success outside of Burlington looks a lot different. Our groups in Burlington have anywhere from 15 to 30 youth at each weekly group, but success in Montpelier or Brattleboro or Rutland might be 5 consistent youth coming. So we look outside of those models for other ways to be successful, and one of the ways that we provide a lot of community space is by working with students and faculty and staff at schools to provide Queer Straight Alliance clubs as a school-based form of community and support.
That's Melissa Murray. She's Executive Director of Outright Vermont. Melissa, thank you for calling in. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Meg Tamulonis, you must have thought about these issues too, queer youth in Vermont having perhaps a different experience or certainly not the resources to decide, well, tonight I'm going to go drive to this space where I know there's a gay night and that I can find some people to talk to. So what about that idea of making spaces, making actual physical places for queer youth?
Absolutely. I'm very supportive of it. I'm supportive of spaces for queer people in general, and I totally get that queer youth would have a different set of needs. But having that space and having the presence of queer people gathering together then, I think, makes some space for queer youth as well.
HB, do you think there is a need? I mean, does it have to be a space that's dedicated to queer people? I mean, this idea of gay bars, we're seeing gay bars shut down in other big cities as well. Is it that there perhaps isn't a need for that kind of congregation? Is there a need for any kind that's separate from the rest of the social life of a community?
I think, I think there definitely is. You know, it feels different when you're in a majority queer space than when you're with a group of queer people at a mostly straight bar or something like that. I definitely feel different, speaking from my own experience. And there is some real value there in celebrating LGBTQ culture and not in losing that. One other thing that we do sort of in recognition of the fact that we don't have spaces like that and somewhat in support of folks who are in recovery or just don't want to be around alcohol, the majority of our events are sober or don't include alcohol. You know, we're not gathering at bars because we don't have those spaces. But it also adds another layer where people of all ages, you know, youth and adults are able to come together and enjoy the same type of events. So we're doing some things like that to create those spaces that are available for everybody.
Let's go to Thomas calling in from Bethel. Hi, Thomas. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you?
Great.
My husband and I, we moved about 5 years ago to Bethel, Vermont.
And I have to say, so far we haven't had any negative experiences, except one maybe. We're really happy up here. We miss sometimes some gay and lesbian gathering places where we can maybe meet some other couples or so. We have a couple of friends, which is nice. This year we had a little bit of a negative experience at the Rutland Regional Medical Center, where my husband had knee replacement surgery, and a doctor, an internal doctor there, gave us a little bit of a hard time because we were gay. He pretended not to know that you could get married in Vermont. He also had a hard time with HIV. My partner's HIV positive. He gave us some very strange, weird comments that he not became a surgeon because of HIV, and we had to file a complaint, and it was kind of weird. The rest of the experience there was overall very, very positive, but that was weird, and it reminded me of the fact that it's still not a perfect world, and that we are still kind of, sort of, well, in certain places, outcasts, you know. And it was weird. It threw me right back in the world when I first came out 30 years ago, and where it was very hard, and where we got called names and couldn't hold hands and all that kind of stuff. But besides that, I have to say Vermont is definitely a very positive place, a very nice place to live, and we are very happy here.
Well, Thomas, thank you very much for sharing your experience, and I'm sorry about that negative one, but I appreciate hearing about it and hearing about, you know, what your lived experience is like. We got a note from Steve in Enosburg who wrote in to say, when I moved to rural Vermont a decade ago, I was surprised at how painfully closeted many gay men were. While the legal civil rights protections are strong, rural exposure to and tolerance for diversity remain weak. A surprising number of rural Vermont men on gay dating websites are not out, and some are in long-term heterosexual marriages despite their orientation. Despite progressive civil rights laws, the social pressures in rural society can be intense. And Suzanne says, I live in Chittenden County and I'm a single parent with young children. I truly admire how much the Pride Center gets done for LGBTQ people in Vermont, but it sure would be nice to have other social outlets outside of their offerings and bars and clubs. A cafe or bookstore downtown would be lovely. On the positive side, living in Vermont today as a gay person in a rural community is night and day from what it was like when I lived in central Vermont in the early 80s, and I'm grateful for that. And let's bring Robert Toms into the conversation. He's the former owner of 135 Pearl, a popular gay bar in Burlington that closed its doors 8 years ago. Robert, welcome to the program. Welcome back, I should say.
Thank you very much. How are you?
I'm well. So when you closed 135 Pearl, there was an outcry in the Burlington area, but did you feel like it was no longer necessary, or was it a purely financial and personal decision for you?
I think it was a couple of things. I think, in all honesty, if it was half its size, and it was fluid financially, it could have continued, but I do not believe with the size of the building, and I don't think we had the volume nor the population to keep a business going 7 days a week.
You now live in Aalborg. How different is that from Burlington culturally for you and your partner?
Well, I mean, I always lived in the Champlain Islands pretty much for the last, I guess, and my partner and I have been together 17 years, and when Bob and I first got together, he lived in Grand Isle, so we just kept on moving to different parts of the Champlain Islands. We're in Aalborg now. And so, I mean, it's always been wonderful, and I chose to come to Lake Champlain Islands because of an energy. I just felt wonderful here, and I've always felt very safe and at peace, but there was also an anonymity about being in a rural area that I was attracted to. So it wasn't so much that I was part of a population, a community. It was like I went into the woods and I went home because I was detoxing from city or urban life.
Mm-hmm. So for you, I mean, having been sort of a figurehead for somebody who was running a gay bar in Vermont, and now, you know, thinking of your life that doesn't include that space, do you think there's a need for bars, coffee shops, bookstores, whatever it is, that's a physical space that's really dedicated to LGBTQ people?
Well, you know, the thing that's interesting, I'm 45 years old now. I started Pearl's 135 Pearl at 23 years old when I took over as manager. And I came in with a Gen X mentality where I wanted a race, gender orientation neutral establishment. Maybe I was ahead of it, and I was coming from this attitude where I don't want to be segregated. I don't want a place that's just for gay folk. I want a place that we all feel safe every aspect of our community, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, allied. And we had an amazing straight contingency, heterosexual contingency that was our huge support system. And we had an amazing, we reached out, we opened the doors, we took chicken wire off windows. We decided, I don't want to be the special place, I want to be part of Burlington. So ultimately, I think on some level, our reign there, we forced assimilation. We brought the queer community into Burlington. In essence, from a business tactic, I mean, we weren't one of one anymore because we were helping bridge our community into other establishments in Chittenden County. And I think ultimately, what we did was very special. So the need for that one place, I think, in my eyes, the need wasn't there. But what we did was very special because it was so all-inclusive.
Well, Robert, I appreciate you bringing us to that point in the discussion, and thanks very much for talking with us. That's Robert Toms, former owner of 135 Pearl. By the way, there is a party in the planning for a reunion party for 135 Pearl. Robert, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
And as we're talking about this idea of assimilation versus culture, let's go to Ewan calling in from Bakersfield. Hi, Ewan. You're on the air.
Hi. I edited Vermont's only gay paper for 4 years, and I've lived in Vermont since 1977, and I've lived in Bakersfield out in the middle of Franklin County, population, I don't know, 1,200 maybe, and for 28 years. So when you're talking about living rurally, I'm there, and I've been here for a long time.
And you in that paper, was that called Out in the Mountains?
That was Out in the Mountains,
mm-hmm.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah,
and, I retain a fondness for the Pride Center, formerly RU12. Hi, Meg.
Hi.
And but there really isn't much out here unless I make it or, you know, somebody else makes it. I could probably name you the six or eight gay couples who live in my town. The library in the next town over, has been very receptive to, events that the Pride Center has organized there for gay families. But, you know, it's, the real issue is assimilation versus, a separate culture. Now, you know, Irish folks, have a culture, and sometimes it's a problematic, depiction of that culture as being, you know, overly alcohol-based. But there's also dance and there's music and lots of other stuff.
Yeah, now, and Ewan, I'm gonna take what you're talking about here, that idea of cultural identity, but with perhaps within a broader American culture. And, you know, we're running short on time, and it's impossible to say, wrap this up for us. You know, where do we go from here? But HB and Meg, I'd love your thoughts, you know, as we traverse this landscape and talk about so many different things in this conversation. Meg, just quickly, what are you thinking?
I think having central places to gather and seek out that culture is crucial. And you can certainly see with assimilation that we might lose some of that, but keeping community centers going will help keep it.
HB, for you?
Yeah, I'll also say this is one of my favorite conversations ever about rural queerness, and I think it's been exciting to see a lot of people coming together about this this show today. So that's great. Let's keep it going. Yeah, I think a lot of people brought up a lot of really interesting points. It's, you know, what do you do and how do you do it? And I think it's exciting to see us as a state, as a rural community, trying to figure that out together. You know, I don't have all the answers. No one has all the answers. Let's keep talking about it.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Let's keep talking about it. You can both keep us up to date on what you're thinking. And listeners, if you want to share your thoughts with us on this program, our line is always open at vpr.net. You can share your comments in the discussion page on Vermont Edition. There's some back and forth already going. HB, I've seen you responding to people already. So carry it on there. Go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. HB Lozito is Executive Director of Green Mountain Crossroads, a Brattleboro nonprofit focused on building visibility for rural LGBTQ folks in New England. We should say this Friday, Crossroads will celebrate Transgender Day of Remembrance. We'll put a link up at vpr.net. And Meg Tamulonis is a former board co-chair of the Pride Center of Vermont and a caretaker of the Vermont Queer Archives. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jane.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermont became the 14th state in the Union in 1791. That required an act of Congress signed by George Washington. But the other states in the Union, as well as Vermont itself, were sent a written announcement of Vermont's statehood. 28 copies of that document were signed by then Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson. This week, one of those Vermont statehood documents will be sold at auction. Joining me now is George Lowry, chairman of Swan Auction Galleries in New York City. George, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So can you just describe what this document looks like?
It doesn't look like anything special. It is a paper, 18th century paper, and it's tall and rather skinny. The actual dimensions are, can't tell you, but the right side of it is slightly discolored, because it's been subject to the elements. It's either sat in the sun for a while. The text is complete, and you can see the outline of the document. The size of it, the actual size of it is about 14 inches high.
Yeah, and you describe it on the auction site, you know, a little bit of tearing on this one side or a little bit of browning. You know, it looks old. You can actually see it. We'll put a link up and you can see what it looks like to
yeah,
look at this document.
It's also illustrated on the website, but it's typical for a very old document that hasn't been particularly well taken care of.
Well, tell us how this came to you. I mean, as I said, there were 28 of these documents that were sent around after Vermont gained statehood. Where has this one been?
We have no idea where it's been. The 28 copies was standard practice for any act of Congress, which would have been 28 copies, would be one copy for each of the original states, plus the extra one for Vermont, and then 14, and the duplicates were kept in the Library of Congress or in some kind of a State Department safe.
Mm. Oh, so that makes up 28.
This one would have been the one sent by Congress to Vermont. It makes it official that the Vermont became the 14th state, and after that, it looks like the state of Vermont didn't take particularly good care of its important documents.
So you think this one actually was the one of the ones that was sent to Vermont, not one of the ones that was sent to one of the other states or kept, obviously, in the Library of Congress?
I suppose it's possible that it was one of the other ones. It certainly is one of the original 28. We assume that it came from Vermont, because that's a Vermont one, because it came from the collection of a man who was very, very into collecting what we would call Vermontiana.
Huh. So how much do you think this is likely to go for? I know that you listed its value or suggested value as between $15,000 and $25,000 on your website.
Yeah, similar documents have brought more than that. They have come on the market. It depends, I guess, on how much interest there is in Vermont history. But the 15 to 25, I would not be surprised if we brought a little bit more than that, $30,000 or $35,000.
From who? What kind of people are interested in this kind of document?
There is very strong interest in individual states. I mean, there are people that collect Michigan. There are people that collect Virginia. There are also people that collect American history. And of course, there's historical societies. Any New York material that comes up, there are two or three major libraries in the state of New York that collect historical documents. And I suppose it's the same thing in Vermont. You know, there are local historical societies, which I can remember from when I owned a house in Townsend. But you know, it's anybody's guess who's going to buy it. The man who owned this was a New Yorker who died at the age of 96. He was a collector, a customer of ours since 1953. And there were two overriding interests that he had. One was Vermont, where apparently he had spent time as a child and loved it. And the other thing he collected was Mormons. And I have no idea why I collected Mormons, but We're selling a great deal of Marvin material from Mr. Slater's collection, and there's a lot of Vermont material from Mr. Slater's collection.
So interested collectors, if they're into Vermont things, or I suppose if they're into Mormon things, but if they're into Vermont things, there's more at this auction than just
and,
that.
And, I think a psychiatrist could have a nice time with that. he must have been a very interesting man. I vaguely remember him, because I've been around for a long time, but... He left in his will the instruction that we should sell his entire collection, which is what we're doing.
Wow.
And so there may be somebody else like him around who spent time in Vermont and is starting to collect the Vermontiana. I mean, that's in answer to your question about who would buy it.
Well, and I guess you have to hope for that at the auction. That's George Lowry. He's chairman of Swan Auction Galleries in New York City. This Thursday, they'll be holding an auction of Revolutionary War era documents, including the one we were talking about earlier, signed by Thomas Jefferson, conferring statehood to Vermont. You can, as I said, see a photo and follow a link to more information if you are that Vermontiana and Mormon collector. Go to vpr.net. You'll find the link there. George, thank you for telling us about it.
Thank you.
VPR's online music project, Live from the Fort, released a new video this week. For the series, we invite Vermont bands into the VPR performance studio to perform and talk about their music, and we're posting the videos of these mini concerts up at vpr.net. We've had great performances from Kat Wright, Marissa Smith, and Waylon Speed, and this week, Anders Parker and Cloud Badge. Here's a track they recorded for Live from the Fort. It's called Animal. That's Anders Parker and Cloud Badge performing Animal, just one song in the concert they did for the VPR series Live from the Fort. Watch the video at vpr.net, and while you're there, tell us what Vermont music acts VPR should profile next. That's it for today. We're still thinking about our earlier conversation on LGBT life in Vermont. Lou Mulvaney-Stanek, well known in the Burlington area and beyond as DJ Lou, writes, "As a lifelong queer Vermonter, community organizer, and leader in the queer community, I fear that many members of the queer and allied community, the ones with financial, political, and social means, see marriage as the end of the fight for a safe, fair, and equal Vermont. Marriage doesn't address the unresolved needs of the queer youth, trans people, single queers, gender variant individuals, alternative family and relationship seekers, etc. So share your thoughts with us. Go to vpr.net, click on today's Vermont edition, and tell us what you think. Tomorrow on the program, you've been called to jury duty. Now what? We'll look at how Vermonters are called to serve for jury duty and get insight into how lawyers determine if they want you to be part of a jury for their trial. Send your questions or comments about serving on a jury to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Isla Yersel. Peter Biello directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.